From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Merry Christmas. It's here and now. And as you're spending time with family today, take a moment to think about the people of Santa Fe, Texas, Thousand Oaks, California, Parkland, Florida, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and so many other places in this country that have had to deal with loss this year after a mass shooting. It's been nearly 2 months since a man opened fire in Pittsburgh's Tree of Life synagogue, killing 11 worshipers and injuring 7 more. We want to check in now with someone we spoke with in November, just after the shooting. Rich Fitzgerald is a lifelong Pittsburgher and a resident of the Squirrel Hill neighborhood where the shooting happened. He's also Allegheny County executive. Rich, thanks for joining us, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Same to you and to everybody out there.
Well, and how's it going right now? It's been now over a month since that terrible shooting in your neighborhood.
Yeah, it has. And I think, you know, the neighborhood is still dealing with it in many ways. And obviously the folks who are closer to the families of the 11 victims, much more so, as they, you know, went through the Hanukkah season, first Hanukkah season without their loved ones. But what I would say is that the closeness of the community, led by not just the rabbis, but people in the community, neighbors, reaching out to each other, Seder dinners, et cetera, were, I'm sure, it took on a different significance, and being with family members took on a greater significance, I think, in light of what happened in late October.
How much are you talking about it? How much are people talking about that event now?
It is still out. It's still something that is talked about. You know, when the mayor's at different events in the neighborhood and even throughout the city, it is talked about. It's also talked about around the nation. I was at our national county executives forum in Boston in mid-December, and you know, my fellow county executives around the country were commenting about it and expressing, you know, concerns and things about seeing Pittsburgh highlighted so much during that period of time on some of the national media. So it's out there, and I think you've even seen it within some of our sports teams and even the visiting teams who we've have a fierce rivalry with. Mm-hmm. The New England Patriots, their owner and players came in and visited the synagogue and some of the members. So it's had an effect of I think bringing people together in some ways.
People also learned a lot about your neighborhood, Squirrel Hill. You described it to us as a special place. It clearly is, based on everything that we heard about it.
It really is, and I raised my family there. My wife and I, 35 years ago, bought a house in Squirrel Hill, and we've lived there ever since. And you know, it's always been a neighborhood of mixed ethnicities, mixed religions, certainly a strong Jewish population, but also a strong Protestant and Catholic and Muslim and Hindu and non-believers. It's kind of a melting pot of diversity. And Pittsburgh's becoming more diverse throughout the region, but Squirrel Hill kind of always was, going back many, many decades.
When you look at what happened, and now with a little bit more time having passed since then, what do you think needs to be done to make sure that it won't happen again?
Well, these things, not just in Squirrel Hill and in synagogues, but unfortunately happen all too often across our country. We've seen it in movie theaters. We've seen it in shopping venues. We've seen it in workplaces. We've seen it in places of worship. So, the vigilance that we need to have with when you see something ahead of time, maybe on social media, that folks are posting things that may tip off some indication that this type of an activity may occur. I think we've got to, you know, certainly move forward on some stricter gun legislation, restrictions on the freedom and the ability for people, particularly with mental health issues, to be able to get such firepower. Obviously puts people in jeopardy and in danger.
Do you have any confidence, though, that that's going to happen after all of these shootings? That's been the call from so many people. There's got to be more gun control, and it never happens.
It doesn't seem to happen. You're right. You know, going back a number of years to where in Sandy Hook. I thought that, you know, you thought that might a number of years ago with those young, you know, nursery school kids, pre-K and young people. The Las Vegas shooting, you could go on and on about the Parkland shooting where it's happened in schools. You've seen a movement about of young people. And you know, I think really when you look at some of the midterm elections, that maybe that does move some people, because I think there were some candidates who won, maybe won in districts that people didn't expect them to win because of the energy of some of the young people who got involved and voted for the first time. So, you know, obviously political movements and political pressures that occur in Washington move a lot of things, and we'll have to see where that goes. This new Congress is going to get sworn in January, and you know, we'll just have to see where the legislation and where the political movement goes with this.
What about the other sort of takeaway from some of this? And President Trump has talked about it, that there just needs to be more security in more places. What do you think about that?
Well, the difficulty with that comes down to where and how, and how do you position people everywhere and pay for it. You know, you think about it, all the houses of worship, all of the schools, all of the movie places. I mean, there's so many places that we gather publicly, our workplaces. So, you know, that one I think is seems to be not as easily accomplished. It's just, you know, we're going to have to keep working on it. There's no easy solution, I think. If there was, we would have done it by now. But our country seems to have this regularity in which these type of things occur, and it's extremely difficult. You know, when it lands in Pittsburgh and it lands in your neighborhood, particularly among such wonderful people, innocent people who are just there to worship, you know, and their lives are taken away and taken away from their families and their friends. It certainly hits close to home, and it makes it very, very difficult and very emotional. And we'll just have to see where the political process takes us.
One of the other things you mentioned a moment ago is social media. After an event like this, everybody starts digging through the shooter's, you know, social media accounts and say, oh, well, we should have seen this that this person wrote, you know, months ago or whatever. Do you think that more can be done there that would make a real difference?
It seems there is, and it seems that is occurring. I mean, I've seen some reports where they have stepped in, and individuals who are starting to display this level of hatred, and then to predict what they're going to do, you know, I'm going to do something, that type of thing. That I think you're seeing a lot more monitoring of those type of dangerous rants, if you will, or posts that occur on some of the platforms and social media. So I do think that's something that you know, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, the, you know, all the different social platforms that are out there, that I think you're going to see more of that. And particularly when you look into the backgrounds, if there is a mental health issue, if there is a criminal justice issue, records that somebody might have, and what type of guns, et cetera, that they might have, that we may be able to stop some of it. But you're never going to reach a point where it's an absolute.
The man accused of carrying out the attack in Pittsburgh has pleaded not guilty, but no trial date has been set. Do you think that a trial is going to bring some closure to people?
That's hard to say. I guess it would matter what how it goes about and what the specifics are occurring. Obviously, something like that will be very emotional and very painful. You know, we have a system of justice that allows people to, you know, go through the court system, and but for, you know, for the family members, and for some of the hatred that was spewed and the actions that were taken, this will be very painful for our community.
And do you think that it's going to be a long time before we finally have a verdict?
I don't know that. I mean, obviously, sometimes the criminal justice system does take a long time. People file motions to appeal. They file motions to delay. You know, there's processes that are in place that oftentimes frustrate a lot of us that as you go through that system, and we'll just have to see where that goes.
Finally, Rich Fitzgerald, this was an attack, obviously, on the Jewish community there in Pittsburgh. You're a Catholic. How are you celebrating Christmas this year?
I celebrate it with my family, my wife and I. You know, we'll have our kids over and we'll spend some time with my parents, with my in-laws, with brothers and sisters and cousins. So being a lifelong Pittsburgher, I have a lot of family here. Some of my kids who are grown live out of town. They will be coming into town, and we will spend it at Mass. Usually we go on Christmas Eve, we'll be together as a family, which is, you know, I'm sure what just about every family wants to do, and many in Pittsburgh treasure that.
That is Rich Fitzgerald, who is the Allegheny County Executive, joining us from Pittsburgh. Thanks again, and Merry Christmas once again to you.
Jeremy, same to you. Thank you.
Listening to Have It All. It's the lead single off the latest album from Jason Mraz, which is called No, K-N-O-W. I spoke with him when the album came out in August. Mraz is 41, grew up in rural Virginia, and has won 2 Grammys. His music spans many genres, from reggae to rap to country, but one thing that is evident, regardless of style, is a feel-good vibe.
The through line for me is always vocally driven, positive articulation. Some stuff that you can sing along to no matter what the genre is.
Let's talk about that positive articulation. I mean, you would definitely be described, I think, as feel good.
Yeah.
Is that by design, or do you think that's just what comes naturally?
A little of both. As a songwriter, I do write songs when I'm sad. I do write songs when I'm frustrated, but those aren't the ones I'm going to bring to the stage, because a stage is typically a place where I've asked 1,000 or 5,000 people to gather to sing and dance and have a good time. So feel-good songs are what I want to bring to that event. Singing makes me feel good. And when I feel good, I sing. And then singing makes me feel good. And it just escalates and becomes a constant feel-good experience.
Just to give people an idea of what we're talking about here, let's listen to a little bit of a song off of your new album. This is called Might As Well Dance.
We got nothing to lose. Take off our pants and jacket. Yeah, we're already fools, so we might as well dance.
Now, in the music video for this song, you actually have footage from your wedding day to your wife,
right,
Christina. You call this new album a love letter to her.
Yeah, and for the video, we had not yet shared our wedding video except with those who attended. And as you know, we were sitting in bed one night looking through different clips that we might be able to use for a video about dancing. We said, well, what if we put a couple of clips from our wedding video of dancing? And then once we started looking at that old footage again, we realized we should just make the entire video about our wedding, because that song started out as a voice memo to her on her voicemail while I was traveling, and I thought it would be a fun way to honor the song.
I hear a lot of people actually use your songs at their weddings. Did you use any of your own songs at your wedding?
I did, but nothing that's been released. the one I used at a wedding was a song I wrote for my wife called The Best Thing I Can Do For You Is Clean Our House.
And it, you didn't want to release that one?
No, not yet. Maybe someday. Maybe, yeah. But it has lines such as, and clean the litter box. You know, very specific things to our daily routines.
How do you stay so upbeat in the face of everything that everyone in this country is dealing with right now? There's a lot of tough things in the news.
Well, I feel that my position can be one that says, let's not forget about love, right? And it's hard to love the other side of the aisle, whatever aisle you're on, you know, whatever side of the street or the protest you're on, it's truly hard to love. But what I feel is that we're all, We all wake up here in 2000-whatever, and we inherit a really gnarly history, a very violent history. And yet we also stand in a really powerful place where the future isn't written yet. And we can, through loving action, rewrite history, change rules, change laws, and help all of humanity. I certainly don't think investing more money and might in military and weaponry is going to create world peace. So I've always been one who stands for love. And if I can stand in the middle of that protest and help people hold hands and see their own humanity in each other's eyes, then maybe that can help resolve some issues.
We're talking about your new album here today, but I actually want to play a song that I've recently discovered from your 2012 album. This is called 93 Million Miles.
Oh, my beautiful mother, she told me, son, in life you're gonna go far. If you do it right, you'll love where you are. Just know.
What were you thinking about when you wrote this song?
Couple of things. First, it was a thank you to my parents because they gave me permission to pursue the arts as a career path. And they said, look, you can always come back home. You can always work back in Richmond, Virginia, my hometown. But go for it. Live your dream, because if you do what you love and you can love what you do, then you've won. You know, that's success. So the song is a thank you to my parents, but it's also a little bit of about science, or at least elevation. My favorite thing about traveling is when you're up in the airplane and you look back down at Earth and you see, sometimes you can even see sort of the curvature of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And when you look at cities and the urban sprawl, every single one of us just seems so empty and meaningless. Whereas when you're down on the Earth, everything's relative and everything seems so important and traffic seems like a nightmare.
Right.
So it's that little bit of distance when you zoom out that is the reminder of how fragile we are and how precious we are. And so it reminds me to just be more loving and grateful for the limited time we have here.
When you look back on some of your older songs, do you ever listen to them now and say, I wish I would have done this differently?
Oh, yeah, totally. I cringe at some of my older material.
Really?
But I also know that I was in my 20s. I was in my early 20s for a lot of that material. And what's on your mind, at least my mind in my early 20s, was trying to get the girl and where's the next party? And it's not dissimilar to many young people's songs about going to the club and trying to say, look at me. So very ego-driven songs. I can't sing those songs today because it's just not who I am. Mm. And so I do end up retiring quite a bit of my material. But as a writer, I'm always excited about the new things I'm writing. So my show still has plenty of music.
Well, and one song that you probably will never be able to retire is perhaps your biggest hit, which is I'm Yours. I want to listen to a little bit of that.
There's no need to complicate our time.
Why do you think that was such a hit?
I don't know, because if I did know, I would try to write more of them, for sure. But this song, I like to say that song's written in primary colors and has a melody that reminded me of a nursery rhyme, something I would have sung in preschool, kindergarten, etc. And it was also, when I wrote it, it wasn't about anyone in particular. It was more about my love of singing and closing my eyes and surrendering to whatever energy and entity inspires one to write or dream or sing. And when I finally recorded it about 4 years later, I did have a girlfriend. So I sang it with a little more emphasis on, you know, on a little more swagger, I guess. Lyrics like scooch on over closer, dear. That wasn't in the original. But I think that giving away that generosity is something that resonates with people, especially those who are getting married or who want to give their life or their time to something. I think that song really resonates.
You've mentioned former girlfriend, your wife. going after the girl. I want to ask you, though, about a love letter that you wrote to the LGBT community during Pride Month. And you had a line in a poem that said, I am by your side with bi spelled B-I. So,
sure.
So what did you mean by that?
Well, I was making an example of my own sexual preferences, which at times have been on either, you know, the female gender or the male gender. So bisexuality, if you will. And as I was writing this letter that Billboard asked me to write, I realized I couldn't write it to a community that stood over there. Mm. I was with that community. So it felt almost like a lie to say, I'm with you. It felt more comforting and more authentic of me to say, yeah, this is who I am. I've been able to stand on both sides. And, you know, being the B in LGBT is sort of the one that's least, I don't know. It has the least potency, if you will. So it's never been something, I would honestly, most of my life, I assume that everyone must be B until they land their identity. But for me, I do feel comfortable in my being. And in fact, one of my working titles for this new album, which is called No, K-N-O-W, was LGBT, and where I put me as the letter B.
Why did you decide against that one?
You know what? I didn't want to make that the only conversation about this record. And by the end of the process, the album became 10 love letters to my wife, which is great. But it just didn't match the that title didn't really match the final curation of the record. Plus, my last album was called Yes, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to have an album called No.
It's Jason Mraz, singer-songwriter. His new album is called No. It is out this week. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on your program.
And you can find out more about Jason's tour at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Arizona's original economy was based on five C's: copper, cattle, cotton, climate, and citrus. But today, the citrus industry is stuck, the lemon market no longer growing thanks to drought and urbanization. Heather Van Blockland of KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
Harold Payne is manager of the 2,000-acre Fort McDowell Tribal Farm, about 30 miles northeast of Phoenix. He grows lemon trees here on just one-tenth of that land, even though prices for the fruit have been steadily rising.
So lemons are actually they're the most profitable, because a lemon tree will produce three times as much fruit as a navel tree, and the prices are higher. So it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out. If you have a choice, you'd be growing lemons.
Worldwide demand for lemons is at an all-time high, as global cooking trends include more Asian and Mediterranean flavors, which include lots of lemon. California and Arizona grow pretty much all the lemon crop for the U.S., but drought and urbanization have limited production.
The problem is there is no more water. All of the water is allocated that is in the rivers in Arizona. It's actually over-allocated.
California's crop has been plagued with wildfire and excessive heat. In Arizona, water is severely limited. Cities and tribes have the highest priority for water rights. Farmers are last in line, and that means a smaller U.S. lemon crop and rising prices. Harold Edwards is CEO of Limonera, one of the oldest and largest citrus growers in the U.S.
And so that's really why you saw the price of lemons rise to very, very high prices towards the end of the summer, was because of the early season and the early harvest of lemon combined with the extreme heat in the latter part of the summer. There just wasn't enough supply to meet the demand.
In early June, the average price of a lemon box was $36. By July, it had jumped to $55. By mid-September, $70.
they tend to be somewhat inelastic from the standpoint of if you go to the grocery store and a lemon costs 30 cents or you go to that same grocery store and it costs 90 cents, consumers typically buy lemons and don't necessarily let that price differential influence their decision.
That may be in part because there's no real alternative flavor for lemons. As the global population grows, demand's expected to continue to increase. Pamela Hamilton is publisher and editor of Edible Phoenix magazine.
Actually, some people who go and will see a tree that isn't being used and will knock on a door and ask if it can be foraged by just seeing things that are going unused and asking permission, which I will stress, ask permission of as someone whose lemon tree was stripped of lemons while she was on vacation last year.
Urban encroachment is also at fault for the decline in Arizona citrus, according to Glenn Wright, a University of Arizona Extension horticulturalist.
Because of urbanization, primarily in the Phoenix area, and a number of years of poor returns, the industry has shrunk to about 12,000 acres.
Arizona lemons now grow on only 15% of the acreage they covered in the 1970s. Arizona's lemon harvest for 2018 is expected to be its lowest in almost a decade, with production declining to less than half of what it was in 2011. For Here and Now, I'm Heather Van Blockland in Phoenix.
I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky, and all that I can see is just a yellow.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, joins us each week. He follows a lot of trends in the economy, in cities, in entertainment. And as we close out 2018, we wanted to check in with him to look at what stood out about this year. Derek joins us now. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And you have brought us some Christmas presents, which is you have come up with some trends that you've been watching this last year. And I will let you start wherever you want.
Yes, everybody's favorite Christmas present, trends. Merry Christmas to us all. So let's start with transportation. I've been really, really excited about the story of self-driving cars. And for a long time, it seemed clear to experts that self-driving cars were an inevitability that would probably arrive on American streets sometime in 2020, 2021. And what I've seen from the last 12 months is that I think we're going to have to push back that time horizon. I think that self-driving cars are going to turn out to be a lot more difficult to get on the road than we thought. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that there's the technology problem, which is that it's really, really difficult, it turns out, to build a car that knows exactly how to drive itself in every circumstance, particularly because the roads in American cities, certainly in other large cities throughout the world, aren't simple grids. You're trying to anticipate not only other drivers, but pedestrians. You're driving around detours. You're driving around potholes. And then on the consumer side, I think there's also a bit of a barrier. So Waymo, for example, which is Google's self-driving car division, recently rolled out an option to allow people to take Waymo, which is a self-driving car rides, as if they were taxis. And the uptake on that has been really slow. It might turn out that customers, consumers, don't trust the technology yet. So there's a kind of chicken and egg problem that exists right now with self-driving cars, and I can see this taking a lot longer. So if you like steering wheels, if you like holding them and pushing your foot on the pedal, well, the good news for you is that I think that's going to be the way that we drive cars for the foreseeable future.
I remember doing a story about escalators once, and one of the things that I took away from it is that they can't make them go too fast because people will be scared to get on them. And I think maybe we're dealing with the same thing with self-driving cars, is that people are still a little scared of the technology, even if the proponents of self-driving cars at this point say that it's safer to have a computer driving the car than a person.
Right. And full disclosure, I've been out to Mountain View. I've been in a Waymo self-driving car. I was driven around California for a few minutes in a self-driving car, and I would report to you that a self-driving car drives a little bit like my grandmother, and which is to say, people don't really know my grandmother, so maybe that's not a lot of information, but she drives very cautiously. These are very, very cautiously driven cars, and I think that they're cautiously driven precisely for the point that you're making. No one wants to step into a self-driving Lamborghini in 2020 and suddenly be accelerated to 90 miles an hour. That feels like a death machine. So I think that Waymo is going about this in a smart way. I just think that the tech is hard, and I think that turning even good tech into a successful consumer product mm-hmm. is a different psychological challenge that's going to have to be overcome.
Okay, so that's trend number one, maybe on hold for now. What's trend number two from Derek Thompson?
Trend number two is in economics. I think for the last few years, really since the Great Recession started, the big story has been that the stock market was doing much better than the labor market. First, the labor market wasn't doing well because we had a jobless recovery. Then we started creating jobs, but the jobs were coming too slowly. Then unemployment finally fell under 5%, under 4%, which is where it is right now. But wage growth was slow. So you've had this long story, which is stock market over labor market. But this year, 2018, seems to be the first time in the last decade, maybe the first time in the entire century, that the labor market is clearly healthier than the stock market, which is a really rare reversal considering that one of the big narratives of the last 30 years has been income inequality. It's been that people who earn a wage are getting rich slower than those who own capital because the stock market has constantly overtaken the labor market. So what I'm interested in is what the Fed does, what the Federal Reserve does, because in a way you can imagine the Federal Reserve raising interest rates in order to sort of clamp down on inflation, make sure that the economy doesn't heat up. But I hope that doesn't happen. I want the labor market to have a little bit of running room. So it is my hope that 2019 will be as fruitful for wages and unemployment as 2018 was, even as I also wish the stock market picks itself up off the ground in the next few months.
Okay, so that's the economic trend you're watching. I know that you also spend a lot of time looking at the world of entertainment. What have you got there?
The big story that I'm paying attention to in entertainment is the movie theater doomed? So first, I was looking at the possible doom of the movie theater when I was writing about Disney. Disney is going to launch a streaming platform in 2019 called Disney Plus. If it really wants to bulk it up, what it should probably do is withhold some movies that might go into movie theaters and put them exclusively on the streaming platform. So if, for example, you're a family that really, really wants to see, like, Black Panther 3, then how valuable would it be if Disney essentially said the only way that you can watch Black Panther 3 is if you subscribe to Disney Plus, the Disney version of Netflix? I think that is the strategy that would make it most successful. But the new reason why I'm a little bit more concerned about movie theaters has to do with Netflix. It released this film, Roma, released on Netflix and in theaters from the Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón. Roma is in many ways considered a front runner for the Oscar for Best Picture, but I can watch it right now on Netflix for no extra cost. I can download it and take it onto the airplane with me.
¿Qué tienes? ¿Querías hablar conmigo? ¿Está bien tu mamá? Sí.
In a world where Netflix and Disney see the movie theater as either optional or even as a detriment to getting people to sign up for their core streaming products, that is a future where the value of the movie theater declines and the cultural iconography of the movie theater declines as well.
I will say that most of the great entertainment that I am watching these days is on streaming or is on television, not at the movie theater.
The average number of tickets bought per person in the United States right now is about 4. In the 1950s, it was about 25.
Wow.
It hasn't really changed that much in the last few years, and that's because in many ways, movies have already declined as the cultural totem of American visual entertainment.
Derek, most of the big, huge life changers over the last couple decades have come in the world of tech, whether it be the iPhone or any number of different products that have come out and really just changed the way that everything happens. What are you seeing in the tech world?
What I'm seeing is not good. There is an acronym, FANG. F-A-A-N-G, that some analysts and investors use to sort of sum up the most valuable and exciting tech companies.
This is Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google.
That is exactly it. All of them, you could argue, have had a bad 2018. Facebook, it almost goes without saying, has had an absolute a horrible year on the privacy side, on the fake news side. But then look at Apple and Amazon. Apple is starting to see smartphone sales flatline for the first time since the iPhone was debuted. And Amazon went through a pretty bad news cycle when HQ2 came out and they chose Washington, D.C. and New York, not the kind of cities that a lot of people were thinking they were going to, they were doing this entire sweepstakes for. You look at Netflix. Netflix has not had a great year. Revenue is not growing. And now an enormous competitor is coming into the market in 2019 with Disney Plus. And then Google, you could say, is probably survived this maelstrom better than any other company. But at the same time, it's also had some difficulties. There's a lot of controversy, for example, about the YouTube algorithm that allows people, young kids especially, to log online and start watching some videos. And then some of the suggested videos that come up on the right-hand side of their screen might include alt-right videos, might include neo-Nazi videos. So they are starting to have the same problems that Facebook has had, which is, as a theoretically nonpartisan platform, how do you determine what kind of content is allowed to be on that platform and what kind of content is not allowed to be on that platform? That's a political decision, but these companies don't want to be seen as making political decisions, and that makes it a conundrum. So all of the FANGs, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you could argue that all of them have had relatively rough 2018s.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who joins us every week here on Here and Now. Derek, thanks for a great 2018. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Don't forget to gift wrap your own trends when you deliver them to friends and family.
Okay. Millions of kids are playing with new toys today. The National Retail Federation estimated that the average American will spend $637 on holiday gifts, the lion's share on toys and electronics. Among the toys predicted to be this year's hot sellers are Harry Potter Lego sets, Hatchimals, Boxer Interactive AI robots, and two dinosaur-themed toys, the Furreal Munchin' Rex and Imaginext Jurassic World Jurassic Rex. So what's the story behind all the toys we're buying? Where are they made? How's the industry doing? Joining us now from New York is Matt Townsend. He covers the toy industry for Bloomberg. Matt, welcome and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for having me.
And as little kids all around America and around the world open up presents today, where are most of them coming from? Is it still China?
Largely China, but that there is some change going on, partly because labor costs have been rising in China, but also, you know, what's going on with the trade dispute between the U.S. and China. You know, we are seeing some movement to markets like Vietnam and India, and even, you know, a little bit of some things coming back to the U.S. Hasbro, you know, one of the big toy companies, actually moved some of its production of Play-Doh back to the U.S. this year for the U.S. market. So there is some shift going on.
And why is that happening in that case? Why move back to the U.S.? Obviously, labor costs are cheaper elsewhere.
You know, basically, the only way to really do it with toys, or really any product for that matter, is if there aren't a lot of labor costs. So if you think about Play-Doh, highly automated, you know, basically just running through machines making dough. If you think about Crayola, you know, they make crayons and colored pencils. They make a lot of products in the U.S. out of their big facility in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which, again, is very highly automated, just basically run a production line. So things that are highly automated can potentially be done within the United States, and you save on shipping costs and all those things coming from overseas.
And what about something like Lego or Playmobil? These are European toys. Are they still made in Europe?
They, for the most part, aren't. I mean, there are some parts of their production lines that are still made in Europe. I was looking up Lego. They do make some of their products in Denmark, but they also make them all over the world, basically, different parts of Asia. You know, it's very much a global supply chain for a company like Lego.
And when you think about where we actually are able to get these toys, we know that Toys R Us went bankrupt and liquidated earlier this year. Who is filling that void?
You know, it's actually funny. It's basically everyone, almost. Even a company like Best Buy, you know, you think electronics, they actually have ramped up the toys that they're selling in their stores. And it's not just electronic toys. It's, you know, Barbie dolls, for example, which is kind of funny when you think about it. But there definitely was a big hole in the market from Toys R Us. And, you know, you saw the big other sort of competitors of Toys R Us, like a Walmart, a Target, or an Amazon. They ramped up their assortments of toys, but also sort of these other players that you wouldn't even expect to find a toy. Party City ramped up their toy assortments. Hmm. So it's really basically everyone trying to grab for that Toys R Us market share, which, you know, is several billion dollars a year just within the Christmas period.
And is Amazon dominating that scramble the way that it does so many other industries? Or is it really kind of there are a lot of competitors there?
There's still a lot of competitors. I mean, Amazon is seeing a pretty big bump up in their sales of toys. You know, I read about earlier this year, they came out with their own printed toy catalog, which is kind of a funny thing that an online retailer would do that. But it's something that, you know, still resonates with a lot of kids and parents. And it was something that Toys R Us was known for doing, too. So, yes, Amazon is definitely gaining some of the market share. But, you know, Walmart, Target, they're also doing quite well with toys.
If you had to rank the health of the toy industry in 2018 on a scale of 1 to 10, what would it be?
I guess about a 4 or 5. I mean, Toys R Us was a huge blow, even though there's a lot of talk about online shopping and, you know, that's where a lot of the growth is. I mean, when it comes to toys, you know, parents do a lot of shopping for toys in physical stores. So not having a dedicated toy retailer in a lot of towns, you know, hurt the industry. And, you know, Hasbro and Mattel, with another big toy maker, they've basically said, you know, they think by the end of next year, the sort of industry will go back to full strength, where all the Toys R Us supply will be taken up by other players.
You know, it's interesting that even though we charge all of our electronics as adults, you still open up a toy and you have to go find batteries.
Yes, it is, yeah. Anyone who has kids knows that
right. You
quickly run out of those AA batteries or AAA batteries. Right. You know, it's almost, at this point, I would think that, you know, battery sales are largely driven by toys, given
right.
that so many of our other products don't need batteries anymore. But yes, no, you know, battery sales surge. Again, Amazon, you know, they have their own, you know, private label, Amazon-branded batteries that they're doing quite well with. So, yeah, and, you know, batteries are sold at Target and Walmart. I'm sure a lot of those sales are going to toys as well. So, yes, the battery business loves the toy business for sure.
Yeah, and the remote control business probably too. Matt Townsend, who covers the toy industry for Bloomberg, thanks again.
Thank you.